The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
I think the website gives you the what you need of the outline. I mean, I could put an outline of the whole class on the web if you want, but it was basically an introductory session where I went over some general things and historical things. Then we spent quite a bit of time on ethology that was partly done independent of the Scott book with the Tinbergen reading, Tinbergen video, Connor Lawrence readings. We read more Lawrence than Tinbergen, focusing on the nature of fixed action patterns and innate releasing mechanisms and releasers. And I talked a little bit about how the ethologists study evolution, do it by comparing behavior of closely related species and trying to figure out the small transitionary step that had led one behavior to become another in a different species. And that's the approach that some of Lawrence's students took. When we go down the names, we'll do a little bit of that in review, but we talked about some plasticity things. I put an outline of Lawrence on learning, but we didn't focus on that. I'll go down a few names I expect you to know in that area. Communication, we spent a little time on that. And then we saw, before we actually covered sociobiology and social behavior, we talked about social animals like the meerkats, and we saw the video, and it's a particularly good video and introduced us to a number of topics important in analyzing social behavior, including the various forms of altruism that they show. And we talked about foraging and feeding behavior, including predation, and then anti-predator behavior. And that's where we read that little thing that I wrote on hamsters because of its focus on anti-predator behavior. Then we had the midterm, and after the midterm there was only one chapter left of the Scott book that was on mating. And I'd hoped to spend a lot more time on that, but in order to have time for sociobiology, we just focused mainly on the Scott coverage and then went right into sociobiology where we had another book. I outline some of the things in E.O. Wilson, but we focused just on the Alcock coverage of where he went over major discoveries that sociobiologists have come to. And he talked about cultural determinism, the nature-nurture problem, various practical applications, the role of genetics in that field. The videos weren't seen by all of you. I put summaries of the cat, chimp, and gorilla things. And then you saw we had the reports. And the reports that were just, I should have had each of you write study questions, like at least two, but I forgot to do that. So, but I've posted all the reports, though. So if I find a topic that came up in a report that we also covered in some way, at least the principles behind it in the class, then you certainly could be able to use examples, because a lot of times I ask for examples if I ask you to define some principle. So you could use examples from your reports, not necessarily from the book. let's, and I can post these names on the web, but let me go down the list of names for you. There were a bunch of names that are related to the ethology things. Okay, and Heinroth and Whitman, the first two names. And I will post these, so I just want to see now if you guys remember who Heinroth and Whitman were. Do you remember? We talked about a lot by Lorenz because of their discovery of the fixed action pattern as inherited behavior. And then Conrad Lorenz, of course, and Nikola Tinbergen. And we didn't read Carl von Frisch, which I often do in such a class, but we talked a little bit about his studies of bees and communication by bees. And then we heard a report on bees also that included bees. Okay, now I mentioned Paul Lehausen and his studies of cats. I don't remember in how much detail I mentioned it. He was one of the Lorenz students. Paul Lehausen, Ibel Ebbesfeld, and Wolfgang Wickler were all Lorenz students who contributed a lot in this field. And Lehausen, his main work was on cats, development, especially predatory behavior in cats. I don't know if you remember the major thing that I pulled out of the reading. I mean, there's a lot of detail. And he, in typical ethologist fashion, he compared the details of attack behavior in different species of cat. He had all kinds of cats you've never heard of that he was studying. And you could see these little differences in their behavior, and you could make out that they had similar functions, and they obviously were related. They had just slight changes from some common ancestor. But the important principle I pulled out of Lehausen is not that easy because it's hard to read, but he found that cats don't, as they develop, they don't show the full pattern of predatory behavior. They show different components of it in their play. Like you'll just see the attack and the pounce behavior. Or you might just see the bite in a play fashion. So they're not actually killing anything. You'll just see the stalking. You'll see the caring behavior. The cats often will kill and then carry their prey someplace before they eat it. And you'll see these different components appearing out of order. It's like they're individual elements. And then, especially under the influence of the mother, they watch the mother. They began to put these things together. But a lot of the putting together, it's like they're putting together a series of fixed action patterns that end up forming a single fixed action pattern, but they're not, that isn't the way they develop. So that means in the brain they have separate representations and they have to be integrated, partly under the influence of learning, we think. And that could be a very important principle in understanding human behavior, because what you could say is that we could have even more instincts than most animals, but what we inherited is these little units of behavior that then we, in our learning, we put together. You know, like we inherit the ability to grasp, that's a fixed action pattern. But exactly how we do it and how we do the little components of it, we have to learn, at least have to integrate in some way. It's a major function of the parts of the brain, especially the corpus striatum. Okay, so that was Lehausen. Ibel Ebbesfeld, we've mentioned several times because he applied the principles of ethology to the study of human behavior did cross-cultural studies of people that had little contact with, or almost no contact with, Westerners. And he showed many of the very same types of behaviors you see in our various societies of in Western culture, Eastern culture, and so forth.
And so what does that tell us, that culture is...
It tells us that it's unlikely that the basic behavior patterns are learned. We pretty much know that now anyway from other things. Somebody mentioned the brain lesion studies the other day, you know, when we were discussing it when David Singer was here, how a person with an asymmetric lesion will have asymmetric voluntary smiling, but when they get a natural smile, it comes out of the hindbrain, it will be symmetric. Their lesion is only affecting the forebrain. And most fixed actions are organized in hindbrain and spinal cord, also the midbrain. The orienting movements are mostly midbrain. Or at least they're higher point of the fixed action patterns. Of the movements, not the motivational component. The motivational component, even though it's present in midbrain, it's most of it for its full expression needs the hypothalamus. But we weren't focusing on brain mechanisms in the course. But it's interesting, and Ivo Levisfeld, if you're interested in that application to human behavior, you should take a look at that book. It's just called Human Ethology, 1975 or 78, I can't remember. And then the last student of Lawrence we mentioned was Wolfgang Wickler. Because of his detailed studies of feeding, social feeding behavior, and the evolution of kissing, billing in birds, it's called. And I mentioned the chapter he wrote, sort of expressing his astonishment that he kept seeing the same things from termites to chimpanzees. But actually, even in humans, but he focused more on animals. Okay, and then the next group of names I have are Darwin and the people important in establishing sociobiology after Darwin, William D. Hamilton. His 1964 paper, and George C. Williams' 1966 paper. Hamilton was the guy who studied extreme altruism, examples of the extreme altruism you see in social insects, with the same topic that Darwin had dealt with, but without knowledge of genes that Hamilton had. And then George C. Williams, whose 1966 paper was a landmark in sort of re-establishing what Darwinian evolution really was, because it had become the idea of survival of the fittest for the benefit of the species that Wynne Edwards had written an entire book about and so forth, and Williams pointed out that was not the real logic of evolution at all. It was individual. He introduced the concept of genetic fitness and so forth, and we've talked a lot about that. That came from George C. Williams initially, and Alcock does a very good job at pointing out how the big changes in research being done after that point. And that led then to E. O. Wilson's synthesis of the field and giving it a name, sociobiology. And you should probably know Stephen Jay Gould, just because he was the most vocal, outspoken critic of sociobiology for reasons that Alcock dealt with quite a bit. We don't look at Gould as a sociobiologist at all, but as a prod in the sides of sociobiologists that led them to improve their science, I would say, and to focus on real scientific issues. They still, I would say, have a right to speculate on humans, but they really do focus on scientific work and findings. Then I mention three names of women, and there's many more actually, who study primate social behavior. I don't think I mentioned that the earliest studies of the gorilla in the wild were done by George Schaller, a man, but he didn't make too many observations, and he didn't come to the findings that these women did in studying apes in the wild. It was Jane Goodall for chimpanzees. Diane Fossey was the first one to study gorillas in the wild, the mountain gorilla. And I mentioned Sarah Hurdy, H-R-D-Y, but I don't remember if she was referred to in any of the things we read. It was its main reference. It was a major reference for Akua's report, but then she didn't come to class to give it because she's had to be out most of the time in the last classes. That big book I loaned her, and she returned during class the other day. It was one of several of Sarah Hurdy's books on ape maternal behavior. She focused on female. Okay, and then the other names are related to plasticity, and I only remember mentioning five, although there's many, of course, people in the field. I mentioned Clark Hull because of his theories, but it's no longer so important. But Pavlov, you should know who Ivan Pavlov was because of the conditional reflex. And it took Lawrence to point out that his analysis of this conditioned salivation in dogs was probably incorrect. It was actually conditioning appetitive behavior in the animal. And that fact, the analysis wasn't done by Lawrence initially, but by another guy, and the work was suppressed, so it wasn't published. Because by that time, Pavlov had become so popular, particularly in America, because where there was a stress on learning, and sort of everything became a conditioned reflex. That was even more true in Russia and the Soviet Union. Everything learned was referred to as Pavlovian conditioning. And then Thorndike, the American, talked about trial and error learning and the role of reward, and that was emphasized by Skinner. And that kind of conditioning we now often call instrumental conditioning. And people then tried to apply it as if it had certain universal rules. It could be applied across species and explain almost all behavior. It wasn't true, but it fit the American preoccupation with learning. And we owe John Garcia a lot for shaking that whole, the foundation of those beliefs, because he showed that it was a type of learning that didn't fit the rules at all, but it did have an adaptive function, because learning also has a genetic basis that evolves because of the advantages to passing on the genes, and different kinds of learning have evolved. And Sokolov, the Russian I mentioned a couple times, showed that even the very, what we often call such a simple kind of learning as habituation, also has very complex aspects. Humans habituate to very complex temporal aspects of stimuli. Anyway, those, you might think of many more names. Do you have any more? Rosa, do you have any more names? No? Already too many. Okay. I don't think these are too many. But let me... I am going to post specific questions, so I'm not going to give you all of those right now, because I don't want to give you all the answers that I know you can come up with yourselves. But I'm going to give you a couple of examples of the kind of question, the bigger questions that I could ask. And I will answer one of them in particular for you, because you may have forgotten. I might ask you to contrast two very different strategies of reproduction. And these are called by the sociobiologists the R strategists and the K strategists. That comes from a formula which I never gave you in class. It's just the formula for population growth. It's expressed as a simple rate of change, dndt, the rate of growth of the rate of change of the population, and it has a simple modifier r times the size of the population, and that's multiplied by k minus the size of the population over k. K is the limiting population size above which it becomes the environment, the carrying capacity environment, it's called. If you look at k as the carrying capacity of the environment, r is actually the rate they multiply. So, you know, bunny rabbits have a high R. They multiply at a great rate. Hamsters have a pretty high R. Biggest ones are little insects that have huge numbers of eggs, you know, after every reproductive sequence. Even if you forget R and K, you could still answer this question, because I would say, contrast two reproductive strategies. I would probably name them and say one has... In one, there are many young, in the other, there's few young. How could each of these be maximizing genetic fitness? And give example. I'd ask for at least one example of each. You know, is the human, which kind is the human? Obviously, the K strategists, they call them. We have few offspring, and we invest a lot of time in them. What kind is a... is a fish, that, like the stickleback. See, that's the other kind. They lay a lot of eggs, or flies that, you know, they're not even there when the larvae hatch out. And not very many of them survive. And yet both strategies have evolved under the same evolutionary idea of maximizing genetic fitness. Another question that I might ask might concern differences in male and female interests with respect to genetic fitness, and how that's led to different mating strategies. If I can figure out a way to formulate a question on that, I'll probably ask one. But I would just point out to you that, remember, if the male and female are the same species, there's got to be some basic harmony. But that doesn't mean the interests are the same, the male and female. So you should take a look at those mating strategies that were outlined in, I believe, both books. If I asked you this, what are the most basic types of movement with multiple purposes? And I ask you to give two examples of each or even more. What are the basic types of movement The trouble with a question like that is types mean different things to different people. But what I'm after is the basic multi-purpose approach and avoidance movements. Approach, it's almost always involves locomotion. There are a few species it doesn't. But from protists all the way up to humans, you have these general purpose actions involving locomotion toward, or at least movement towards, and movement away. And they have multiple purposes. You have to move towards a potential mate, you have to move towards potential food, you have to move towards a nest or shelter, etc. You have to move away from predators, move away from an irritating stimulus, move away from somebody you don't like, this and that. I mean, you have multiple, these are multi-purpose movements. And we read about them a bit when we were reading about reading Lawrence.
Other than locomotion?
Locomotion towards and locomotion away, mm-hmm. because they are actually different movements a bit. And there are different ways to move away from something. You can turn your head away too. That's a movement away. Okay, so the two types of movements, whether it involves locomotion or not, are basically approach and avoidance. So approach and avoidance are the easiest way to express that, these two types of movement. But in your examples, you would probably pick things involving locomotion or head movement and point out the different purposes they could have. Yeah?
Was foraging a class
of foraging? Foraging isn't a single movement. Foraging is appetitive behavior involved in feeding, but there are specific fixed action patterns that are involved in foraging that have their own, if I'm remembering Lawrence, they have their own action, specific potential, their own motivation. And if animals are just fed in a cage and they can't forage, then they will still build up this need to forage. So we know they're separate. Remember in the attack behavior of cats, a cat that's just fed, deprived of attack, will still build up the desire to attack. And you can show it's independent from hunger because they'll jump right over a bowl of tuna fish to if they're really interested in attacking a mouse. And they prefer to attack the mouse. That was shown by brain stimulation studies too, where you increase their predatory drive by brain stimulation, and you can show that it's very specific to a live prey object. Let me give you two more. I'll try to remember what I said so I can put all these online. Distinguish between reflex movements, fixed action patterns, or instinctive movements, and voluntary movements. Now, I would probably have to leave out that last part because we didn't really talk about voluntary movements very much in the class. And it's more controversial exactly how we should define it. It can be done more easily in terms of the brain mechanisms involved. But we certainly distinguished between reflexes and fixed action patterns, and you should look at fixed action patterns as synonymous with instinctive movements.
They're different from reflex movements.
Different from reflex movements, because...
And you want to explain this without the brain mechanisms?
No, if you want to use brain mechanisms, it's okay. But try to give a behavioral definition first, and then you can use the brain mechanisms to help you in your argument.
Okay, so what's the behavior?
Reflex movements as defined by Lorenz, and it was actually Hassenstein that Lorenz was following in this, don't involve an action-specific potential, a drive, a motivational component that builds up over time. So I argued that even some simple thing that we certainly call a reflex, like the eye blink, we call it the eye blink reflex, really has characteristics of a fixed action pattern in the sense that you do have a drive to blink your eyes, and if you don't blink your eyes, it builds up. That's why staring at somebody without blinking is a challenge, because the longer you go without blinking your eyes, the more you want to do it. So that's probably the simplest fixed action pattern I can think of. But many reflexes don't have that, like withdrawal reflex. Any painful stimulus, a sharp object, a burn or something, will cause you to withdraw. You know, and there's no motivational component to it. You can define it in the same way they do fixed action pattern. If you just say there's no endogenous component at all, but there is a component, it builds up as soon as there's the stimulus. But it builds up very fast, so it becomes almost meaningless to call it. So that's what we call a reflex, according to Hassenstein and Lorenz, in that there's no motivational component that builds up. And there are many reflexes involved in coordination of locomotion, for example, that are always there. They always happen. It doesn't mean the sensitivity can't vary. It can. And it doesn't mean that certainly your tendency to withdraw will change with your expectations. If you're expecting something dangerous to happen, you will withdraw much more readily. But those are because of descending influences onto the spinal cord. It's not a motivation that builds up in the sense that it's just time. It builds up because of expectation of the higher brain mechanism.
Resist reflexes, but not
effective. Can I do that?
Resist.
You can certainly influence many reflexes.
But not
voluntarily.
Fixed action patterns.
No, you can influence fixed action patterns too.
What?
But the pattern, the main influence is one of suppression or enhancement. The pattern we can imitate, like when we smile. We can deliberately smile for social reasons. But some people are really good at distinguishing a fake smile from a real smile. But what we mean by a fake smile, it doesn't mean it's not a smile. It just means it's not a fixed action pattern being generated. It's a voluntary movement. I wish we had talked a little more about voluntary movements, but that was the one situation that we discussed where that came up.
Yeah. I remember you said there's one thing you disagree with Balcock about. I think has to do with fixed action pattern, how it's influenced and not influenced by the environment.
That's the last question I'll give you here. What is the basic solution to the nature-nurture debate concerning the origins of behavior? It's a huge debate that's been raging for many, many years. Is behavior learned or is it inherited? Is this behavior learned or is it inherited? They usually talk about it specifically with regard to one thing. And Alcock took an extreme position saying basically it doesn't even make sense to ask that because all behaviors are influenced by the environment and by genetics. And I took issue with that, saying that there are some behaviors that are for all practical purposes completely fixed in the genes. See, the fixed aspect of a fixed action pattern is in the fixed aspect is in the genes, which makes it very similar from one member of the species to the other. But like turkey gobbling is just not influenced by learning in any way that we can detect. But there aren't many things like that. Lawrence points that out. Most things have some influence of learning during development, during the ontogeny of the behavior.
What was the example of the one that was? The
turkey gobbling, the gobble gobble response of the turkey.
But the turkey, wouldn't they produce a different gobble if they were deprived of all, like if you took a turkey and you took it away from all other turkeys, wouldn't he have developed an abnormal gobble?
I don't know that that's been done. It's an interesting question. I'm not sure. Just because a behavior varies a little bit from one member of a species to another doesn't mean that it's not mainly inherited. It doesn't mean that the variations you are observing are due to learning. Okay, they may be, and it's likely that they are, but they can also be due to genetic variation. Behavioral traits vary across the population with variations in genetics, just like physical traits vary. So a type of smile can run in a family, for example. A type of walk can run in the family. For many, many different movements, that's true. So don't think of variations as always due to learning. Many people get confused about that. They look at all variations as due to changes that occurred during development, influences the environment, and so forth, different rewards occurring, and so forth.
Is the false dichotomy between culture and biology the same thing as nature and nurture question, or the different?
No, it's the same.
Same question.
Cultural determinism means learning from the culture. Much social behavior by sociologists is considered learned, influenced by the culture. Culture determines how you behave. And of course the sociobiologists and the ethologists beg to differ with that view. We're not saying culture isn't extremely important. It certainly is. Especially for humans. And it's been found to be important in ape societies too, that they pass on certain traits. The use of tools by the chimps to get termites is something the young chimp has to learn from the parent, usually the mother. The washing of food by rhesus monkeys along the ocean shore in Japan is learned. There's a number of behaviors like that animals have to learn from. And there are now some studies of that where if you heard DeWall talk in the Teuber Memorial Lecture, he talked about that, specific experiments where they teach one animal, usually an animal that has some social standing in the group. So it's the more dominant female usually, and they teach her something. Like he will have two methods of getting into a box to get food. The box can be opened in two distinctly different ways, by shoving a stick into it or by sliding a thing. And they will teach the female one of those. And then they put her in the colony where that box is available. The others watch her do that, and they learn that method. And almost all the others gradually use that method to solve the problem. I mean, it's not an easy box to solve, so they did get a few of them, when they taught the sliding method, a few of them learn to poke the stick in, because apparently that's a natural behavior of the chimps that were being, no, I think it was a monkey species she was doing. He was doing, he did some on chimps, he did some on monkeys. But those were the first experiments like that that I've seen, formal experiments showing the spread of something that became a cultural thing among the primate colony. And he's pretty well known for that kind of work, which is why we invited him to give the talk last week. So you see, I will try to come up with some of the, if I think something is really basic to understanding ethology or to understanding what sociobiology is all about, I'm likely to ask some form of that question. So make sure you understand the basics, what fixed action patterns are, how do we know about them. So I might ask for a few people. And examples too. And sociobiology likewise came, of course, originally from Darwin, but that's true of much of ethology too. I mean, both ethologists and sociobiologists will cite Darwin's book, The Expression of the Emotions in Animals and Humans and Animals and Man, as a sort of primary source, the original source of that work. And in my initial lecture, I showed a few pictures from Darwin's book. Darwin took a huge amount of time to write those books, years and years. He knew the kind of controversy that he would run into. And he knew he had to amass a huge amount of data, which is why his trip, which to the Galapagos Islands and other places, was so important. And he was very young when he initially made those voyages and started collecting data. And he was not young anymore when he wrote this book, published the book. So now he wouldn't survive as a scientist because he wouldn't get enough support. You know, science has such a different structure now. Maybe in theoretical physics you can develop a theory over years and so forth and succeed, but not in experimental work so much anymore. Okay, we're already beyond time, but we've taken about an hour.